You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Dr. Kathleen Smith back to the podcast. Dr. Smith is a licensed therapist and associate faculty member of the Bowen Center for Study of the Family. She is the author of Everything Isn't Terrible, which is the book that we talked about last time she was on the pod. And she's got a new book. It's called True to You, A Therapist's Guide to Stop Pleasing Others and Start Being Yourself. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money you spend. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the end.
Kathleen Smith, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. The very first line of the introduction of your new book is, quote, humans are master pretenders, end quote. Say more.
It's so hard to tell what, how mature we are, how smart we are, how capable we are, because we are very good at pretending we're very mature or very capable or the opposite, right? And there are any number of things sort of buoying us up or bringing us down at any given moment. And that's, to me, that's both a comforting statement and kind of a sobering one as well, because our relationships with each other have a lot to do with our own functioning.
We're also, I mean, is it also related to how hardwired we are for story? And the stories
Absolutely.
We tell ourselves about our lives, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, who the characters we think we are and then the people we're responding to, our fantasies about them and our nightmares about them also.
I find as I have gotten older, certainly for myself, the story I told about my family life looks very different in the rearview mirror. And when I talk to other people who are roughly in, who are basically who are in their 50s, they tend to have the same thing, that the story wasn't the story. The story changed, and the story continues to change. And I think that is, I had no schema for that as a young person. You're younger than me. Like, I mean, did this come out of the scientific research? Is this me search? Where did it all come for you?
I think I used to tell people sort of before I got interested in family therapy or family systems that was my family was fine. We're chugging along. There's not really anything there to think about, you know, and obviously I think very differently today, but I think, I was having a conversation with my husband yesterday about family secrets and how it's hard to tell whether your family is a family who has secrets or not, right? Because how would you know, right?
How would you know?
And, you know, I think there's a lot these days, like DNA tests, everything. It's a little bit harder to keep secrets than it used to be.
Yeah.
And something I am continually fascinated by as a therapist is just when people start to uncover these things. I mean, it's just wild and endlessly entertaining. I mean, and they had no idea. So it's I think once you get curious, you're really along for the ride.
So this is a tangent, but I'm interested in going there. It also makes me think of the fact that, you know, we talk so much about the crisis around young people today and the sort of reports of loneliness and other things. And I also can't help but think, like, haven't we been telling young people for like the last 15 years they should be more open and honest with their feelings, and now they're doing it and we don't like it?
I think we also have to be open and honest with sort of what the purpose of, let's say, the family is too, you know? Yeah. And people use the word support a lot, that your family is there to support you and be there for you and whatever you choose, right? And that's great if you have that. That's fantastic. But I think the family is also for playing ball a little bit, you know? And when a person can kind of take that up, I think that, you know, that goes along sort of with improv too, but like, that's where people start to have fun. You know, it's with the characters you're given, you know, that doesn't mean that you sign up for everything or you put up with everything, but how is that a different way of thinking about it than I'm going to share my feelings and people need to respond in a particular way to them?
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever thought about home as a potential hazing practice, but absolutely. I mean, I'm the youngest of six boys. So right. If you think that that didn't happen, it absolutely happened. All right. Before we go too much farther, and I know you did this when you were on the podcast last time, but talk about Bowen family systems theory, because I honestly, when I talk to most people about this, they don't know what that is. And it's really, really interesting.
Sure. So Murray Bowen was a guy who was a psychiatrist and a researcher. He was on the faculty here in D.C. at Georgetown. And he sort of came up in the sort of the mid 20th century. And you think about people who are psychiatrists or therapists, you know, back in sort of World War II, that era, they're all getting trained in psychoanalytic theory, right? Freud, that's really what everyone is getting. And he was very frustrated with how there wasn't much of a connection to evolution or the natural world. We sort of trick ourselves into thinking that humans are these unicorns that are somehow the exceptions to the laws of nature, right? And so he wanted to sort of have human behavior rooted more in science, and how looking to the natural world would help people think about their relationships and their relationship systems, right? It's not so much about who's the patient and who's the problem as it is about how the group functions have an impact on how I function. Yeah. And if I'm working on myself or getting a little more responsible self for myself, maybe, how is that useful to other people in my family, in the systems that I'm a part of? And so he did this fascinating study with NIMH, where they could never do this now because they're just, for good reason, right? Mm-hmm. But they studied people who had schizophrenia, and they brought their entire families onto the ward to live with them. And they were observing how, you know, he wasn't saying your mother may, you know, caused your schizophrenia, but he was saying how people responded to people and their challenges in the family had a huge impact on how well a person did, right? And so maybe all of the focus doesn't have to be on the person who has a particular diagnosis or challenge. You can work with other people in the system, and they can be resources to each other, and that's tremendously helpful. And so it's just a different way of thinking about challenges than traditional therapy, where we tend to identify one person as the patient or the person who needs to do the changing. It's sort of whoever wants to volunteer can be that person. And I found that really helpful in my personal life as well.
Yeah. So that's interesting. And it works its way, of course, into your book. And it reminds me, we had a podcast recently with Allison Forgale, who has written a terrific new book on women in the workforce called Likeable Badass. And a lot of her book is about sort of like getting rid of this, like, you know, talking a lot about office politics. She's like, of course there's office politics. Why would you think there wouldn't be? It's groups of people trying to figure out these things and like worrying about things being fair, calling things a game. It's like, well, it shouldn't be a game. It's like games are models of how the world works. That is a huge part of how we learn. And of course, because of our work in improv, we're very pro game. And you write in chapter one is called How We Lose Ourselves. You say, quote, "We look for patterns not to blame our ancestors, but to take the bullseye off a single person's back. There is no one person who needs to be fixed, and there is no one relationship that has to be the focus of therapy. Every human interaction is an opportunity for learning to build a self, and every movement towards maturity benefits our relationships. When we limit our scope to the current fire, we usually end up getting burned," end quote. Killer. That is killer. It's well written, but also it's this thing that you're talking about, which is you have to consider the whole and you have to consider the context, and the context changes, but it's always, you're always existing inside a system that is ever changing, which makes it harder, right?
Absolutely. And people are not going to cooperate, you know? And so which our
and people aren't going to cooperate. Oh no, we're screwed.
Yeah, and we get so good at becoming sort of students of other people's immaturities or their own sort of flaws, right? It's and that itself is stabilizing to focus on everybody else.
Yeah. All right. So going with that, a big tenet of improvisation is the idea of being others focused. And you know, our idea is that a lot of us are worrying about ourselves in certain kinds of situations. And sometimes when you can really be successful by putting the focus on others, that is a superpower. And as my friend Nir Eyal says, it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. Talk to us a bit about that problem when we focus too much on others, the other side of this coin.
Sure. You know, I think that's important to recognize. And as humans, we're really good at it. You know, a human toddler is better at predicting what a person is about to do or what they're thinking than any other adult primate. So we are primed for being able to make pretty good guesses. And it's useful to pay attention to what other people are about to do, right? Mm-hmm. But to me, it's sort of where is the energy going, right? And can you take the focus maybe of a researcher, of somebody who's really curious about what someone's doing to either get comfortable or, you know, what's predictable for them, right? How that's different than what in Bowen theory is called a relationship orientation, which sounds great, right? But it's this focus on people needing to be a certain way and on people needing to respond in a certain way to you, right? And that there's not a lot of freedom or creativity in that kind of focus, because you really act as if you've already got people figured out, right? Mm-hmm. Which is sort of the opposite of paying attention to them, which we tend to do.
It also feels like you're giving them a script.
Yeah.
And we know this, like there was a period here. So we create our shows through improvisation, obviously. And the third act is where when we're in process, we're writing the show and we're doing it through improvisation. There was a certain period here where some directors got it in their mind that really they should just take their scripts up there. And they did. And the shows weren't very good. And I was like, of course, because they can't evolve. Because once you have a script, you're stuck in that character. You're stuck in that line. And the whole idea of creating improvisationally in front of an audience is allowing a thing to emerge. And that can feel like magic, and it can be really scary, but it's also quite powerful. And it is, in fact, how the world mostly does operate. And we get gummed up sometimes with these scripts.
Yeah, and that's a question I ask people like when they go home for Thanksgiving. Is I don't use the word script, but I could, you know, I could say, tell me what will happen.
Yeah.
If you're not paying attention or you're not trying to do something different, you know, we know the scripts, you know, we know what people do to get cozy, you know, and so kind of moving a little bit about outside of that, I think that's where the interesting things happen, right? In our relationships, and you start to get interested in people in a different way.
So a big part of the Bowen work, and this comes up throughout the entire book, is this idea of differentiation of self. So talk us through what that is.
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked before, you know, how we just have this tremendous capacity to sort of do what's expected of us, right? To think and act based on what other people want us to be, or to try and get other people to be what we want them to be, you know, but we also have this individuality as humans. We have this ability to put our thinking into action, this ability to maybe be a little bit more of ourselves, regardless of who's in the room, right? And that one person operating with that amount of freedom, or what in Bowen theory is called that amount of differentiation, right? It doesn't mean that people will love it. They'll have all kinds of reactions to it. Mm-hmm. But it also frees up the system to do cool things, to solve problems, to meet goals, because less of the energy is going into sort of trying to control each other, right? Bringing that amount of individuality. And that's sort of, it's thought about sort of what the work is, where are the hard places to kind of go and put your thinking into action, or to say, well, I don't know, Bob, I think about that differently, you know, the ability to take a position on something, right? Or be a little bit more principled. I mean, it's not very sexy sounding, but it's very difficult to do, you know, especially in anxious times. And so people who can kind of be on the lookout for those opportunities, you know, they start to have a little fun, and they realize they can maybe do more than they thought they could.
So I'm curious. So I think about in America and culturally, it strikes me there's a tension between how we think about the self. So there's one aspect, Whitman, we contain multitudes. And then there's also the, well, that person's a flip-flopper. You know, and my sort of where I live right now is that I am many selves. I am many selves in many different situations. And that doesn't mean I'm inauthentic. And I have a story about this, and it relates to Michael Morris's book Tribal that I'm reading right now, where he talks about Obama and code switching. And literally, Obama, when he was running for the first time, came here. We had a show called Between Barack and a Hard Place, very prescient on our part. And when he greeted me and our owner, Andrew Alexander, at the steps of the stairs, he shook our hands and he was like, thank you so much for having me here. The minute he went backstage with the actors, he was like, you guys. But it made the most sense in the world to me of like, it's a different audience, it's a different experience. And he was just sort of adapting. And I felt he was actually quite masterful at it. So can you talk a little bit about what that means to you and to the book in particular?
I mean, I can't relate completely to that. I am a Southerner, so I can turn my Tennessee accent on and off at will, which I do sometimes. But, you know, I think to me, it's all about the choice. It's not about so much the action as it is whether anxiety is the driving force or not. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, a person who can think, how do I want to represent myself? Do I have a little bit of control over that? And that there's some thought going into that, right? It doesn't mean you have to be the exact same person in any group of people. But then where is anxiety the driving force? You know, where is there an opportunity maybe to not have to put so much energy into that? And I recognize people have different challenges. There are people, you know, beside myself who have to think about this every day about how they want to represent themselves. And it, you know, I recognize that, but, to me, it's sort of the direction of where the energy is going in. Is it how you want to represent yourself, or is it just the quickest way to calm things down? And maybe you don't have to do it in that sense.
Yeah, I suppose for other people, they feel they have to hide inside a personality that's not theirs. And that's a dark side of that. Sure. All right. I want to ask you, talk about mind reading and mind knowing. And I specifically remember when Nick Epley at the University of Chicago wanted to observe a class because we were just starting to work together, looking at behavioral science and improvisation in a program that we created. And he came to my wife Ann's class, and she was doing a gibberish exercise. So basically, you had two people who were going to speak in gibberish and a person in the middle who was translating for each of them. It leads to lots of laughter. But afterwards, Epley asked the actors, he said, do you think you actually understood what the person was saying when they were using gibberish? And both of them said, yeah, I think I got the gist of it. And then when they told them what they were intending to say, they was so wildly off. And Epley leads that to being like, we can't read minds.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Is that what do you think about that?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, I think we are pretty good at making guesses maybe about how people are feeling or they are reacting, but that I think just gets in the way, and you can be very wrong. And I think the level of stress and anxiety also has an impact on our capacity to do that. I think that's one of the challenges in kind of the virtual world today and lots of Zoom meetings and everything. People are much more likely to misinterpret or assume somebody's annoyed with them without very much evidence, right? You need that in-person piece of it too. But yeah, I think, you know, often with people, and it's with their families, you know, they talk to me about what a family member thinks about something. And I say, well, have you asked them? my mom's going to need me to take care of her when she gets older. Have you asked her that?
Yeah.
Most of the time people haven't, you know, and they might be correct, but who knows? You know, if you don't give the other person a chance to, like I said, represent themselves in their thinking, how much gets lost, right? And how much extra work are you doing with what could have been an actual conversation, you know, and how is mind reading its own form of distancing where that person to person contact is really useful. And so, you know, we're just so quick to do it because we're pretty good at it. But.
Right. Right.
You know, you lose something.
You also talk in the book about this idea of underfunctioning and overfunctioning for yourself. Do you pin yourself in one of those categories?
I'm fabulous at both. So,
all right, then talk about it. Talk about both.
I mean, my husband will tell you I'm fabulous at pretending that I can't do things I actually can, and I'm fabulous at doing things for him that he can do for himself and is okay. not needed, right? So we go back and forth. But the idea is sort of that this is this pattern that kind of shakes out into kind of a seesaw. We have these comfortable ways of relating to each other. And for some people, you know, maybe it's the oldest child in the family, or sometimes, you know, women, you know, oldest sisters too, you know, they're more comfortable being over responsible for people. And it's a two-way street, right? Like, it's easy to blame one person. Why are you doing so much for them? Or why can't you help out more? But there's a reciprocity in it, right? People do things that invite us to take over for them. And we do things to them that invite them to underfunction, right? And so it doesn't really matter who started it. It's just that either person could change the pattern, right? And for better or worse, it's just kind of a way of steadying ourselves, you know, when something's stressful. But over time, there's a tremendous cost to it. There's not a lot of flexibility, like I said, or creativity in how you relate to somebody. It's hard to be curious about someone when you always think you know what they should be doing, right? So,
but it seems impossible to me to avoid those conditions in some regard. Do you think that, though, it's if you're aware, you can navigate it more, maybe more successfully?
To me, it is a part of nature. It is tremendously adaptive. I always go back to that. I'm always telling people, you know, if they're complaining about their kids or their coworkers, I say, well, you know, 25% of ants in a colony are just hanging out. You know? This is built in to a degree in a system, right? And so I don't think of it in terms of good or bad, but flexibility. You know, I write a lot about this baseball metaphor of being a utility player and being able to move around the field. And that's how I think about it. Like, if you go into a group or you're visiting your family, and you're always doing everything for everybody, that, you know, can you move off of first base a little bit? Can you let people help you out? Can you just sit there and enjoy somebody's company? Like, how much can you move from one position to another? How much versatility is there? And I think that's where people really see some progress. It's not that they're not going to overfunction for people at times, but it's just, you know, how much can you kind of move out of it in situations where it's not really called for? I think that's really cool when people can do that.
You talk about the self-help industry and you say, quote, there's nothing wrong with consuming content. The trouble is it's easy to get stuck in the consuming phase where we think about changing because it can feel like progress. That really hit home for me.
Yeah, I mean, that dopamine feels pretty good. That's my favorite way to procrastinate, is to listen to productivity podcasts. It's a problem that I have. Because it makes me feel good about all the great changes I'm going to make, right? And I don't have to sit down and think so much if somebody's just telling me what to do. And I think I just have this theory that our level of societal anxiety is just directly correlated to the amount of, like, helpful content we consume, you know? And then there's the dilemma of how do you market a self-help book?
Right, encouraging
people to think for themselves and sit down, you know, and with their own ability to evaluate what, you know, how do they meet a challenge. It's hard. I still haven't quite figured that out. But it's not that there's not room for help or advice. It's just, is it about calming yourself down as quickly as possible, or is it about learning something? And often I think it's the former. It's more about steadying ourselves than really responding to challenges, because it's just so automatic and it's so available. I mean, with social media and everything else, it's just, you know, you can consume all day, every day.
There was a point last year where my therapist forbade me from listening to any more political podcasts. She's like, this is not healthy for you. You come in and talk about that. And I moved to history podcasts, and my son's endlessly making fun of me, though he's pleased at my age that, you know, I went with World War II podcast as opposed to, you know, a trophy wife or a, you know, expensive car. I also remember the study that was done of the Colbert Report back in the day, where they found that people who consume that kind of content were sometimes less likely to vote because they already felt like they did their bit.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I think I can see how that can happen. I think, I actually think, you know, having this podcast requires me to sort of see the whole thing through, because I read your book and I underline as I go. But then when I'm preparing for the podcast, I get that book out and I decide what from there I might be interested in talking about and finding sort of, you know, connections, then have you get it back to me where I'm right, where I'm wrong, where there's shades. And that allows for, you know, some, I don't know, the stuff always hits me and I'm able to sort of adapt it and bring it in and use it just a little bit. I remember some of the productivity hacks that I actually used that have worked. Like, I set out my workout clothes the night before, and that has been very effective for me.
Sure.
Stuff like that. But it's hard to unbreak these patterns. That's the point, though, right?
Yeah, but I ask people, you know, it's not about giving these things up. It's about putting a little bit more percentage of self into them. You know, I might ask somebody, how many parenting books have you read or podcasts have you listened to? How many minutes have you sat down with your own thinking to write down your principles as a parent? You know, which can change. That's fine. Yeah. But for most of us, I mean, it's not a lot of time, right? And so, you know, even just putting 1 or 2% more of yourself and your own prefrontal cortex into the equation, I think is helpful for people.
I almost led with this. It's at the end of the book where you say, quote, more than ever, the world needs grownups. What's a grownup mean to you?
Well, this colleague of mine, Dr. Michael Kerr, he uses the phrase grownup solutions. And I really love this phrase because it just, to me, when I say what's the grownup solution here, it often points me in the direction I need to move, right?
Yeah.
I think because we have the automatic and the anxious and the emotional, which we're in most of the time, that serves its purpose, right? You know, but to me, a grownup is a person who's focused on self, who's able to stay in plugged into challenges for the long haul, you know, longer than just the news cycle. The people who are not caught up in growing other people up. You know, Dr. Bowen had this very folksy saying of, you can't make a bean grow by pulling on it, you know, and I think a lot of us these days are pulling on beans.
We are pulling on beans.
You know, and I think those are the people who don't command the most attention. But I feel very fortunate to have some colleagues and folks in my life who are doing those things. And it's always inspiring to me.
We're actually working with this foundation in Wisconsin, the Argosy Foundation, who contacted us because they want to fund comedic content creators to create comedy that encourages people to disagree with civility, that attempts to say, like, you can have your deep-seated opinion, that's fantastic, and you can also acknowledge another person who feels differently than you as another human being, as a multifaceted sort of person. And I was sort of, we took on the gig, and I was curious how our talent were going to come back, because I'm working with a lot of very young people, that the demographic that would be saying is doing this, and like, no one had a problem with it. Like, everyone's like, get it. I can do that, which was actually very encouraging to me, because I was not sure, you know, how that was going to be taken by some 20 somethings
sure.
who are in the field of comedy who have very strong opinions.
Sure. Yeah.
So you write in the book, you say, quote, as far as I know, no one has ever been pressured, pulled, or bullied into greater maturity. So that's a big part of this, which is, you know, our options in terms of how you can't make someone else just change. Right?
Yeah. And I think how much energy do we put into that, you know? And how much energy do we put into how we function, how we represent ourselves? You know, it doesn't mean that you don't share your thinking with people. But the energy that goes into convincing to some of the bullying, you know, I always ask people, you know, how effective has that been? People might fall in line for a time, but there's not a lot of self in that, right? It's just, right. it's all out of anxiety. And I think that there's a cost to that, you know. Does it get people to act quickly sometimes and be quiet? Sure. You know, but I think that's kind of more of a symptom fixing than how the whole system functions, you know.
Yeah. All right. In a moment, we're going to ask you for a thank you because story, which we always do with a return guest. But before that, there's a section on moving past parental blame. And you give this really compelling example of how we learn to interpret negative outcomes as intentional and positive outcomes as unintentional. And it's a mom taking you to the park. Can you talk us that? I thought that was a really great story that explained a phenomenon.
Yeah, we have this bias where good things that happen to us, we tend to attribute to chance. And then bad things that happen to us, we tend to see as being sort of very personal and against us. And it typically tends to be our parents or the people who raised us, you know? And I think that's why it's so helpful to zoom out and go back a generation or two and get a sense of what people were up against and how they adapted to that. And how does that... you know, I did this with my dad's family. I made a list of every stressful event that had happened for 100 years in the family, you know, and wow. You look at that list and you go, we're doing pretty good, you know?
Yeah. Given the generational trauma.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that that just takes the focus, like, you know, the quote you read earlier, it takes the focus off of one particular individual, you know, and it sees that for better or worse, some people end up in freer positions than others, you know, especially in a family. And there's not much we can do about that other than get curious about how you get a little bit of outside of it yourself. And so anytime somebody can make that move and see, you know, get out of that narrative, we're storytellers, right? So there has to be a villain, there has to be a motive, right? And that, I think, nature, evolution, they don't operate that way, you know? And I think if we can apply humans to that, it really puts the focus back on you versus sort of whose fault that was.
Well, and I think, too, when you think about us as storytellers, I don't know, but I think the best stories are the ones that have all those twists and turns and surprises when the bad guy ends up being kind of good and the good guy sometimes ends up being bad and it's nuanced and it's interesting. So, I mean, you know, go for the more interesting story.
Yeah, I have a 5-year-old and who is fascinated with villains, and I'm always asking about characters she likes, and I say, oh, are they a good guy or are they a bad guy? And sometimes she'll say, oh, he's a medium guy, you know? And I'm like, aren't we all medium guys?
Aren't we all medium guys? Out of the mouths of babes. That's so awesome. All right. Do you have a thank you because story for us?
Yeah, I was thinking about how I've learned to be grateful for family members in particular, especially some of the stranger ones. Uh-huh. And I, you know, and I, with my clients too, when they can start to do this, when they can start to say, this person is a gift, you know, somebody they've been complaining about for a long time. And so I was thinking about one uncle I have in particular. I was raised sort of evangelical, and I was very much like raised as like a 90s Christian kid, which is like its own.
Oh, wow.
Culture.
Yeah, no, that's a thing.
And I have an uncle who, whenever I see him, will present me with like 10 handwritten pages about why we're in the end times and the apocalypse is nigh. And I have some pretty traumatic like rapture scare stories from my childhood.
Uh-huh.
So I can be very negative about that. But what, you know, but I think over time, sort of with some of the family systems thinking I've been doing, I just see that as such an opportunity to get clearer with myself and with him about I don't believe that, you know, mm-hmm. What my experiences have been, you know. And I remember the last time he sort of presented them to me, I said, yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I remember being a kid and being very upset that Jesus might come back before Seinfeld was over, you know, that really.
Or before... How did you respond to this? What was the response to this?
It just sort of jolted him out of him trying to convince me of anything. Okay. Right. Like it just, yeah. You know, it was, we were, like I said earlier, we were playing ball, you know?
Yeah.
And like, just, he was not, he was expecting me to sort of shove it in my pocket and say, oh, thanks, I'll take a look at it.
Or fight you.
Or fight him. Yeah. And I didn't do either of those things. No. Right. You know? Mm-hmm. And so I think moving, it doesn't mean that you have to be grateful for everything every family member does. Right. But like when you can kind of move in that space of being grateful for the opportunities that people give us to share our thinking with them, you know, even if it's different, what a cool thing that is. You know? Like, oh, look, here's an opportunity for me to talk about what television shows I liked when I was growing up, you know.
It's so funny because like there's so many of my friends who started here who ended up on like Jordan Klepper on The Daily Show goes out and talks to, you know, voters who don't share his politics. But he always does this with he's got a sort of a sweet baby face.
Right.
And he's always does it with curiosity. And it's always just a wonderful way to sort of show the sort of what's going on, but in kind of not with any judgment, just kind of like engaging with someone with curiosity. And there, everything is less threatening when it's done with that, with the sort of like with a smile and with a genuine sort of concern. And we talk in our field about replacing blame with curiosity as a mindset, when you're, especially in the comedy business, when you have hecklers and other people, and how can I bring them into the fold with this and just make it part of what the story that's going on. It's not easy to do is yeah. True. And the thing that we always sort of say is like, find places to practice. So
absolutely.
It seems to me like, you know, that you're doing that with your uncle, right? You're practicing.
Yeah. I mean, family can be the hardest place, but also I think, you know, there's tremendous benefit to it. I call it, you know, not giving into the relationship, but not giving up on the relationship either. It's That's kind nice. Of this in-between place of where nobody has to really give up their individuality. There's not pressure moving in either direction. And that's cool, you know, when that can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in most cases you can make that work.
Yeah.
Yeah. The book is called True to You, A Therapist's Guide to Stop Pleasing Others and Start Being Yourself. Kathleen Smith, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.